Hey, it's Eric Newcomer. Welcome to the Newcomer Podcast. We've got two conversations from our banking summit. First up is my chat with Ahmad Akun, the CEO of Mercury, followed by Jackie Reses, former top Square executive and now the CEO of Lead Bank. Both companies are competing aggressively for the banking business. Mercury is a little bit more in the direct customer facing. It is not itself a bank. It is working with partner banks. Meanwhile, Jackie's Lead Bank is a chartered bank and is often sort of behind many of the financial technology product that you're familiar with. Give it a listen.
Can you just start off, why did you start Mercury? Actually, what is the founding story?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I've been doing startups since 2006. So, and then how many years is that? I've lost count. 16, 17. And I was just always really frustrated with kind of the banking experience that I had. You know, in 2006, as an entrepreneur, everything sucked. Right? I remember, like, there was no Slack, there was no Stripe. Like, I did the thing that you did before Stripe existed, which is impossible. And then I had this idea for Mercury in 2013, and basically everything had improved apart from banking, and banking was the same, kind of, you know, not to be harsh to them, 100-year-old institutions that, like, have the same product, and, you know, maybe they have a mobile app, but they're not, like, kind of this product-led, and, you know, frankly, the expectations I had for, like, software and services were just way higher, and I didn't think the banks were going to build it.
How long did it take to have something that people could use from the start of the business?
Yeah, so I had this idea in 2013, and then I sold my previous company in 2016. And at the start of 2017, I was like, okay, you know, I think I know what to do on the product and, you know, how to get customers, but I had no idea how to kind of launch a bank account. So basically 2017, I kind of started, and, you know, at the same time I was having a kid and all this, so it wasn't like full time. And then, you know, figured out how to do it, and we decided to go kind of the route where we partner with existing banks. And it took us about a year and a half kind of from like starting building it to kind of doing bank partnership and getting everything live and launching in April 2019.
And how transformative or not was the SVB crisis for Mercury? Like on the one hand, I imagine it's like, oh, we need a new bank account. You're easy to open. On the other hand, you know, if people are running to JP Morgan, are they, you know, going to a startup for their banking? Or how did that play out for you?
I thought it might be fun to do a little show of hands. I don't know how many entrepreneurs are there, but how many people use Mercury? All right. How many people from that used it because of March 2023 versus just before? So, yeah, everyone there already used Mercury. So I think, like, you know, we've been doing this since 2019, and we've been growing, you know, fairly consistently and fairly fast. We, you know, went from basically a nine-person kind of seed stage company to raised a Series A and then the Series B in 2021. And, you know, 2023, especially March, it was definitely significant for us at the time. There was a, you know, big blip. We got about 8,700 kind of customers in a short
8,700. Do you say what a percent increase that was or anything like that?
So we've said it before. We have about 100,000 kind of customers, more than 100,000 customers live, something like that. So, you know, you can get the rough idea. So we were already, you know, fairly big at the time, but it was definitely like a significant bump. And obviously these customers were on the bigger side in general. What it has done for us is it's really kind of been an inflection point in terms of how fast we've been growing. So even since then, you know, we've been growing basically twice as fast as we were pre-SVB. So like January and February this year were our biggest, like, excluding that 1 month in March, were by far our biggest kind of months we've ever had. And I think it's really, when I think about product, I think about like amazing user experience and all these things. When, you know, when banks think about product, they mean like what kind of loan they can sell you, right? So it's like a very different mindset. And I think tech-enabled companies and entrepreneurs, like, you know, they're looking for a banking service that matches the rest of the expectations of the software they use.
All right, we've got a banking service. Or like you go to your website, you know, banking, I think, is the first word. But then you have this, like, we are not a bank. We work with Choice Financial Group or whatever. I think people here are savvy enough to understand that probably. But the decision not to be a bank is a pretty core one. Why did you decide to be the software platform, work with banks, and not be a bank yourself?
I think in general, you know, people want to feel like their money's safe. and people want a great product. And they don't care too much if like Mercury is a bank or not. And actually, I think we can provide a much safer product by not being a bank. So by default, anyone that signs up to Mercury gets a sweep account, and we sweep it to kind of 20 banks underneath the hood. So it's
five. Some of the traditional banks like will have sweep, but it's not default. Is that sort of the tension?
Yeah, I mean, yes, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get these kinds of things at banks. Yes, it's possible, like they call it ICS, but it's not easy. And then, you know, we also have kind of US government T-bill product called Mercury Treasury that makes it very easy to put your money together. And that's something we launched over the weekend when this SVB crisis happened. We launched something called Mercury Vault, which helps you understand where your money is. And we also extended FDIC insurance from 1 million to kind of 3 and then 5. So overall, I think it matters a lot more to be kind of a chartered bank if you are doing lending. I think, you know, there's not that many fintechs that have pulled on like at scale lending without being a bank. But in terms of providing depository services, payments, kind of all the software that you need to run your business, I don't think you need to be a bank.
Are you going to reevaluate the decision?
I mean, we look at it every year. Yeah, in the UK, actually, most of the neobanks became banks because the UK has like some kind of fintech friendly charters. So does Germany and Brazil. So yeah, the US hasn't done that.
Are you in the UK?
No.
So that's your way of saying, oh, if we wanted to go to the UK, we would have to become a bank?
No, I mean, okay. There's also other ways to, and you can partner there as well. I'm just from the UK, so I always, I always think about the UK. And like that was actually part of Mercury's inspiration. Like there's a lot more. Yeah, now actually the US has caught up to some extent, but in 2017, there was a ton more innovation in kind of new banking in Europe.
What are the main ways right now that Mercury generates revenue?
Yeah, so we have five or so revenue streams. We have a lot of deposits and we have a very deposit-rich kind of customer base. So we make money both on our treasury part. We have kind of fees on it.
And the treasury is like, you run that.
Yeah.
And the deposits, the bank runs it and pays you some money.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So those are two. And then we have both credit cards and debit cards, and we get interchange on those. And we also have FX. And we also have a venture debt lending book. We get fees, but we work with the bank on that, and we get fees from that as well.
You're just like a funnel to them, basically?
Well, we do all the servicing, origination, but they do the balance sheet part.
And would you want to do lending yourself?
Well, we're not a bank, so we can't do it using our deposits. So we always have like some balance sheet provider for it. But yeah, we're growing the lending book as well. Venture debt is our current kind of product there, but we're kind of experimenting with others.
I mean, a big theme of the day has been, what's the state of relationship banking, right? I mean, we've got like several banks that are basically Stifel or Citizens or whatever that are premised on, you know, you liked us at this bank, you'll love us at this bank, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a belief in relationship banking. I think Matt's presentation was very sort of skeptical of that model. If people are able to use like generative AI models to price shop and sort of that inertia goes away and people are much more conscious of getting the best deal. You know, you're sort of focused on product. What do you think of relationships when it comes to banking?
Yeah, I mean, my experience with relationship banking was I need to send a wire and I literally cannot figure out how to do it. Please help me. Which like to me never felt like a relationship. It felt very transactional and like painful. And with Mercury, you don't have to do that. I think there is an element of like, okay, things are getting complicated. I'm considering loan options and things like that. And I think for those relationships matter a little bit more. I would say, ideally, there is a product that can answer your questions, right? Like, if you take lending, ideally, it's like, hey, we already have your banking data and like here's a generated loan that you just click on to accept, right? Like, I think that would be the better customer experience. But, you know, we have relationship managers now and we do that as well. But, yeah, I don't think that's the future. I think the future is a product-based approach to banking. And I think, frankly, that's kind of one people want. There's definitely elements where, you know, you want to make sure there's someone there. And sometimes that human can really help you. But, you know, maybe the AI can answer all your questions.
Sure, okay, right? So I was going to ask about AI. Like, generative AI.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're experimenting with it. Where do you think it might be useful to your business?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first part of Matt's presentation on the Gen AI thing is like, hey, increases efficiency. I think there's definitely elements of that, and we're already experimenting. You know, when it comes to fraud and things like that, there's always been machine learning anyway. And yeah, there's other, I don't know if Gen AI plays a big piece there, but customer service, understanding, you know, even something like receipts, like it's way better to like OCR them using kind of these modern techniques. So there's lots of like these kind of efficiency things to be had. And that's where our focus has been.
On the regulatory front, I mean, there's clearly been some push for fintech companies to have a tighter relationship with the underlying banks. Or how would you characterize sort of the pressure and feedback that you're getting in terms of your banking partners and how much they want them to be involved with your business?
On a high level, 2021 saw a ton of innovation, like a lot of fintechs, you know, launched. But actually, a lot of new partner banks came along that, like, previously were not partnering with fintechs that started partnering with it. So, and then, yeah, when there was the crypto crisis of 2022, there was a lot of companies that kind of had issues, and then obviously the SVB thing, the regulators.
You're saying those were red flags? It's like crypto, SVB, I think like, you know, bubble, fintech.
From a regulatory perspective, it's like, hey, we need to check out what's happening in Silicon Valley, right? And that's fair. We've always kind of operated on like, you know, we do business banking. Like, we're not doing any weird crypto thing, right? Like, I mean, I like crypto, but...
No crypto for Mercury.
Well, we're not doing any crypto products. Yeah. But yeah, we've always done like fairly vanilla products, but just in from a regulatory perspective, but you know, obviously packaged in a really nice way. And we've always felt that compliance and risk is like a very important thing for us to get right. And we've always invested heavily in it. So I think the current regulatory scrutiny and both fintechs and these banks having to kind of look at what they're doing and go, hey, you know, are we doing this in like a fully compliant way? I think it's healthy, and we're going to come out of this with, there'll probably be less fintechs and there'll probably be less kind of banks that work with fintechs, but the ones that come out on the other side will be in a kind of much healthier position and with like, you know, products that hopefully are in a position where they can scale.
How does it translate on just cost? Or, you know, are you just having to do more work telling your banking partners about customers, or is it having, yeah, does it change sort of the cost structure of your business?
Yeah, I don't think it changes the unit economics and costs significantly. I think it's, you know, you can still, and like, you know, businesses like Mercury will always have like a lot more kind of automation, and even when we have people, we can give them a lot of leverage with the tools we build. So we have our own risk product team, and we build, yeah, we still use third parties, but a lot of our tools are built internally, so we can like do things really fast and with a lot of information. So overall, I don't think it changes the risk. Like, it doesn't change the unit economics. What we try to really be careful about is, you know, how does it change the user experience? And actually, you know, one of the things to think about is like a lot of the time when people complain about their banking or financial services experience, what they're really complaining about is like, my account froze, or I couldn't get this thing done, or it was slow to do this. And those are all like actually like compliance and risk friction. So how do we do that in a way that actually like is a, some of the friction is necessary, but I don't think it's all necessary, right? Like if you've already collected a document on the user, like let's make sure that we don't have to ask them again, right? Or like preemptively, if we know something's going to come up, let's try to be ahead of it. So that's the kind of thing we think about a lot.
You work with two banks right now, right?
Well, it's complicated, but yeah, we have two main partner banks, but we also have kind of two providers on the international payment side. And we also, with Mercury Treasury, we work with Apex as our custodian.
Is that a good equilibrium, or is there sort of an ideal, you know, one bank, mini banks, or how do you think about why have two? Or
I think two is a good number. Maybe three is slightly better, but I think one is bad because you need redundancy. And I think it's, as a fintech, it's responsible to have like multiple partners that you can work with. I think if you have more than three, it's just going to be a lot of work to follow all the rules and make sure everyone is like fully abreast on things. So I think two is a good number. For us, it's, you know, we have a really strong and deep relationship with both of the partner banks. So, you know, we talk directly with them, both in terms of the technology side and the kind of compliance counterparts and things like that. So, yeah, and it's important for us to go really deep there.
You know, we heard, I think, on the Rippling panel, this idea, okay, where you really need to dig deep with partner banks, especially if you're like a big company. I've been hitting on this theme, but like, you know, Mercury is the brand, but then it sort of leads your customer not to do or think about the underlying banks, or how much, I guess when you're dealing with bigger customers, are you spending more time educating them on the banks behind Mercury?
So I think Matt Harris said this, and I completely agree that I don't think our customers should be checking the balance sheet of them. I mean, also, like, did you see his graphs? Like, who's here even? And we're banking experts as, like, qualified to look at all this data to make an assessment on their bank. And, like, you know, were people looking at SVB data and going, like, oh, this might have a bank run? So I don't think that's realistic. I mean, I think it's much better to go, like, hey, we have 5 million in FDIC insurance, and anything above that you can put into US government T-bills. Like, you know, that is something where we can help our customers understand how that works, and we have a lot of information, and we have this product called Vault where we explain it. But I feel like that's the answer. I don't think the answer is everyone's going to become bank experts.
I'm going to open it up to questions soon. How has it been living through the fintech hype cycle, or where are we right now? You know, what's your read on the mood in terms of venture capital and fintech companies like your own?
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2021, serious hype cycle. I've been in the valley since 2007, so I'm like a little immune to these things. But, you know, I much prefer building a company outside a hype cycle. It's easier to hire people and, you know, you get less competition. Like, there was a while where everyone was like, every single product is going to have a bank account attached to it. And I was skeptical, but, you know, obviously as a startup, I'm like, well, maybe every single company is going to compete against us or something. But I think it's healthier. And yeah, overall, like, I just looked this up because I was like, what percentage of GDP is financial services? So it's 8.3%, according to a quick Google I did earlier. So that's huge, right? And I think the trends that are underlying it, yeah, everyone's interacting with things on their phone. This generative AI trend that Matt talked about, like, it's inevitable that most people will relate to financial services via tech products. Some of that's going to be from existing banks, but I think a lot of it is going to be from fintech. So I think these trends are going to go on for a long time. I'm happier to do it outside a hype cycle, though.
Any questions?
The question was, where does BaaS 2.0 go? I think, you know, there's this movement. There was a moment in time where a lot of banks wanted to work with fintechs, but they couldn't do it easily. And, you know, BaaS kind of sprang up as like the middleman in the space. I think the next set of things is banks either themselves or working with technology providers to have BaaS internally. And that's basically what we're seeing. So, you know, Column and Lead are these two kind of BaaS banks where, you know, we have Silicon Valley people go buy a bank and then apply technology to it. The two banks we work with, Choice and Evolve, have built all of the tech internally to work with us and to work with other fintechs. I really think that's the future. And not just from a regulatory perspective, it's also just like, you know, if you can remove the middleman and there's one less person taking margins, like, it's just kind of an inevitability. So that's where I see it going. And I think that's like, if you go 3 years from now, I would think most banks will be working directly with fintechs, especially at scale. I think the bit that the middlemen do really help with is when you're first starting out. When Mercury launched, there was only 9 of us at Mercury, and that would have been quite hard to get like a direct bank partnership done and be able to service that fully.
Lead's next. Like, have you thought about working with them, or Lead or Column, or yeah?
We don't work with them currently, but I'm a huge fan of Jackie. Where is she? hi, Jackie. And William over at Column, so I'm sure we will at some point. Yeah, I guess it depends why you're looking for diversification. I think the way the Sweep network works and, you know, on Mercury Treasury, like, at least in terms of, like, putting your money somewhere safe, I think that we've got that covered. And Mercury's been profitable for the last 6, almost 7 quarters. So, you know, we feel like we're in a very stable place and we think about the long term. So I would say you'll be happy with Mercury.
So just one bank?
Sure. I mean, we're not one bank. We're a platform. We're not a bank at all, actually.
If you were to start a fintech company today besides your own, is there an area you're excited about, or where would you?
You know, honestly, I'm pretty excited about these Gen AI agents. Someone's going to have to make those. I actually invested in a company building like fintech Gen AI agents. I think those look really cool.
What do they do?
Well, they're not live, so I won't say exactly what they do, but it's this exact thing. It's like, hey, if you want to buy car insurance or mortgage. Like, who wants to click those buttons, like, have it automated, find me the best one, swap it out whenever something cheaper comes, you know? It's like that kind of thing.
My final question, you know, it's sort of this same take stock question I've been asking. Like, as a founder, you know, watching like an institution like Silicon Valley Bank unravel, like, did you do anything differently afterwards, or how did it change your perspective as a CEO?
I mean, for us, it was a weird moment, right? Because they were the 800-pound gorilla competitor for us, right? Like, when we launched, people would say, like, oh yeah, why would I not use SVB instead of Mercury? Like, it was always a thing. And then, you know, post March, like, I don't know if we've been fully reversed, but it feels like a very different world, right? Like, now when I talk to customers, it's, I'm sorry, Mark from SVB. But when I talk to customers, it's mostly like, should I use JPMC or should I use Mercury? Like, those are the conversations now. So, like, the paradigm has shifted quite a bit. And yeah, I was really sad about it. Like, I used SVB in my previous company. And, you know, I think even though we were competing against them, like, I never thought badly of them. I think they're like great people. So yeah, it was a sad moment. It also gave us this opportunity to grow faster.
Great. Ahmad, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jackie Reeses, lead bank. Thank you for joining me.
Of course, I'm happy to.
So yeah, you are a bank and a fintech, all in one.
Yes, I've built one and I've bought one.
How did you become a bank? Tell us that story.
I went and bought one. Having built one as a de novo charter at Square, it was one of the most painful experiences of my life. One of my co-founders is here, Hammam. It was probably the most painful experience of his life as well, because he spent years working with the FDIC, teaching and working on algorithmic lending, for example, and going through how machine learning works. But in that process, you realize when you write the first lines of code and you write the first set of policies and procedures, that you get to think about banking in a first principles mindset of, like, what should this be and how would I build it? And so it really changes the framework for how you would think, like, huh, I have just started from zero. I'm going to build the ultimate bank. Now, in that context, we were able to think of that, but we were only serving one customer. And so
That's
at Square. But it made it more obvious that no one had built the bank we wanted to be. And we had worked across the industry with many of what I would describe as the best banking partners even still out there while we were at Square. And we saw many challenges as a customer. And so given that, we decided that there was a better way to do this. And there are four of us who left Square, Erica Khalili and Ronak Vyas, so my other two co-founders. And we searched across the country for a certain profile of charter that we were looking for that we thought would maximize the opportunity of banking as a service. And we went and found the best high quality company we could, and that's Lead Bank. And Lead Bank was owned by a very old school family in Kansas City that were very well known. You know, the mom, who was the chairman of the bank, is the chairman of the symphony. Very philanthropic city. The banks are absolutely gorgeous. If you walk in, you'd be amazed.
Are you still operating?
Absolutely. Oh, we're a part of the community. And
are the owners involved anymore?
We are now the owners.
Yeah, so they're gone.
We bought it 100%, but we thought very methodically about what charter we wanted, what company we wanted, what kind of employees we wanted, in what kind of location, and in what state. And so we ended up with an A-plus opportunity, because even if everything wasn't perfect at Lead before we owned it, and there are examples where you're like, oh, that's kind of, you know, not perfect in their history, it had the infrastructure and mindset of the team that we could use to go build and continue to grow banking as a service.
How big was the acquisition?
About $52 million.
And what was the first product that you wanted to provide? Or what, when you bought it, you're like, okay, now we are a fintech bank. Like, what was the beginning?
The best part of Lead was that they already were a fintech bank and they had wonderful clients. And so we were able to take what was already there and supplement with some of the world's greatest engineers. And so our engineering team is amazing. We knew almost everybody that we hired right out of the gate. They all came from Square, from Stripe, from Yahoo. They'd built some of the largest payment systems in the world. They built some of the largest banking systems in the world. And several of them have accounting degrees and CFAs. And so they have been through the ringer with us in prior circumstances around building out APIs for banking products. And so we took what was already a strong banking as a service partner bank and then added us, added the engineering and product team, added a much deeper compliance and legal team. And with that came extreme product market fit. And I will say extreme product market fit. And so we don't have sales. We don't have marketing. We have inbounds of people who know us, who have been credentialized through people we know, through compliance teams we know, and we have an extreme level of inbound interest in working with us.
Your partners, like, what are they getting? Like, what services are you providing?
So four main product areas. So lending, all kinds of lending APIs around any kind of card product, any kind of loan product, buy now, pay later. Accounts, so either virtual accounts or actual DDAs that you might need. Payment rails, so all kinds of money movement, things like that. And then issuing. And so card issuing, BIN sponsorship, things like that. The only thing we don't do and don't have on our roadmap right now is acquiring. And it's just, frankly, because of our size. We're about $1.1 billion in assets right now. And when we're bigger in size, I think we'd look at doing acquiring in the future. It's just not anywhere on our... We have so much to build with such strong inbound demand.
Do you want a customer-facing brand at all, or you want to be facilitating other companies to build those brands?
So in Kansas City, our home market, we take a really active presence and we have amazing customers. We have 3,000 customers in...
Is that a regulatory strategy or...?
It's a strategy to stay active in the market because the purpose of community banks in a local market is to serve the community. And we are blessed with a great group of clients, some of whom I've become really good friends with. And there's someone here from Kansas City. Where is he? Where'd you go? There he is. He knows where we're at in Kansas City and likes how we show up. Thank you very much. And, you know, there's no reason to stop it. We have an amazing customer base.
But you were saying that is the public-facing part.
It is
otherwise
the public-facing part. We have an app. It's built by Fiserv. It's awful. If Frank were here, I'd ask that he update the design of that app on behalf of community banks across the United States. But that is a customer-facing community bank app. And so most of the business locally is real estate developers. They're not in office. They're in mixed-use kinds of activities. We don't have any issues with regard to liquidity, deposits, bad loans. The bank actually operated pretty clean from a lending point of view, and we diligence that pretty actively. And then the other part of the business, which is the growth, is banking as a service. But interestingly, even some of our local clients want to use like ACH rails because they're a real estate developer and they want to work with clients to do ACH. And while their volume might be smaller because they're local, they love the fact that we could bring technology feedback to them to support their own banking needs. That's not everybody. Out of the 3,000, maybe that's 20. But it feels good to be able to change the nature of what we do in a local community and bring technology expertise to Kansas
City. Who are some of your bigger customers that you can talk about? Or
there are only a few that are public. And one of our strategies is to not really talk about our customers, let them talk about us if they want to. And so we show up on a few websites like Ramp and Affirm, a few other fintechs like Flex and Credit Key. But otherwise, I don't know that anyone's put us on their website, so I won't comment. Our clients are some of the biggest e-commerce, fintech, big and scaling also, fintech, e-commerce, consumer companies. We have many public companies on our rails. We have many up-and-comers of people that came through our network that we know that we want to help support, that we feel like have really good, strong teams. We know who they are. We know who their compliance teams are. And so we vet all the inbounds. But thankfully, we're part of the tech community. So we usually know these folks. And through someone in our network, we have pretty good insight into what kind of operator they are and what the perspective is on the likely growth of their business. And so we do have several small clients on our rails. And then we also have some crypto companies on our rails. And we're one of the only banks in the U.S. that's been through a full three-year exam with crypto that has been included in our bank. And I think that when we went through those exams, I think it's because the depth of understanding of the team and the type of enhanced due diligence we did with those clients in order to take fiat-only currency, I think they believed through our behavior, through the understanding of the products, that we were able to understand how to do enhanced due diligence and what to look for with red flags.
Outside of the community bank, do you hold a lot of customer deposits on behalf of these companies, or it's mostly money passing through?
So part of the strategy with fintechs is that in some cases, for some of the products, there is more liquidity that stays on your balance sheet. In some cases, it's very short duration. In other cases, it's, you know, holding customer funds on behalf of a fintech, because we work with fintechs to try to be a good partner to them. And rate is one component of being a good partner to them. Rate is not our strategy, though, and by any stretch of the imagination. What we build and how we execute from a technology point of view is the strategy. And so I'd say they come to us first for the way we build products and the way we operate from a compliance point of view and the way we are foundationally strong financially. How we operate across the balance sheet is just one component of the conversation.
How do you substantiate that you're financially strong? Or what are the key signals?
Then this was something that came up in the last discussion, is people have to do due diligence on us. And thankfully, we report numbers to the FDIC every quarter. And so everyone can pull up our call report. And we advise fintechs before they choose a bank to go do reverse diligence
on us. What are the key numbers? Give us some of the... What will we find?
We did about $140 million in sales last year, $55 million of what I describe as gross profit, and $16.4 million in net income. And so we're $1.1 billion in assets. Those numbers are publicly available. There's nothing secretive about them.
You're supposed to position this as a big...
The big reveal. No, but, you know, it's interesting as a size point of view, because we're actually a pretty big partner bank size. You know, most people want to partner with someone below the Durbin size, which is $10 billion.
So that they can make money on interchange?
Well, you can make money either way. It's just a matter of how the fees are calculated. But it's more that there aren't that many that are actually that big in scale. There's a handful. And then when you look by product, there are only a handful that are good at different kinds of products. And so we've already distinguished ourselves. You know, we bought this bank about 2 years ago. We've already distinguished ourselves in size pretty substantially and kind of separated ourselves from a pack of smaller players. And so when people do due diligence on us, first of all, like, our CFO's bio is extraordinary. Then you talk to her and you're like, this woman knows what she is doing. She was the ex-CFO of post-bankruptcy Lehman Brothers. And so she managed the entire dissolution of their $132 billion balance sheet and had been working there for 10 years. And before that, ran FP&A at Willis. And so she has an extreme level of detailed understanding of complexity of balance sheet at scale. And she has a detailed understanding of how to build unusual balance sheet structures in order to support the financing needs of clients. Then I'd make one more point. She doesn't come from tech. So she can look at us and call bullshit and say, like, yeah, I get that. Yeah, we're not going to do that. And let's figure out why and what makes sense and why you're going to do something. And it helps makes the conversation better when you're not all coming from a closed ecosystem of understanding. You want to have divergent perspectives in order to make the conversation smarter. And so she's a very can-do person. I think she has an incredible approach. But when a client goes and, you know, asks her questions about how we manage risk, how we manage intraday money flows, because I do think that's going to be the challenge of banks for the next few years because of the complexity of money moving soon, 24/7, 365. There's not enough volume yet, but it's coming. And all the flows amongst all the counterparties are still not aligned yet. And so, you know, I wanted someone who was going to understand that complexity.
So you're saying just the speed of money movement is going to become the core issue, or I just want to
speed of money movement, velocity of what flows intraday, because most of the metrics that are looked at are measured at ends of periods. Ends of are not a distinctive moment for liquidity challenges. And in some cases, there's mismatches of windows that operate between all different kinds of counterparties. That might be fine where you have closed Fed windows, and I think Matt touched on this a little bit, but when you are in a world with Fed now and 24/7 money movement, you have to make sure that every counterparty can pull to the same moment in time. And today, that's not the case.
Big question, but what is your broad read on regulatory friendliness to fintechs right now, or how much has sort of regulatory scrutiny changed how you operate?
Where you operate within the guidelines and confines of the regulation, I haven't seen issues. Full stop. Where you're able to actually answer questions and substantively step back with a framework of understanding around how your clients operate, KYC, KYB, red flags, I haven't seen any issues. Full stop. Now, that doesn't mean that regulators are necessarily forward-looking to take proactive views of, you know, how the market's moving, and they're not on their forefront or their forward foot trying to change the way banking operates to experiment. But last I checked, when the American taxpayer is insuring banks, I don't know that we all as taxpayers want banking regulators to be flippant about risks that banks are taking. And so, you know, you hope that where there's innovation and features of what people are doing around the edges, that regulators will operate and understand them. But I think they need to see data first. And, you know, I'm pretty thankful that they're pretty detailed in their analysis. And so where you have very high profile, high class, very strong compliant customers, I think they operate, you know, quite safely within the context of banks that they work with.
Do you have to say no to your clients a lot, or it's more just building the product in a way that they couldn't?
It's definitely not a no. It's most of our clients are super high quality. They want to scale, and they want to scale safely. Having a mistake from a banking point of view is existential. No one wants to do something stupid. And so the situation I am more likely to see is not understanding something. And when you explain it with a strong rationale, I rarely see instances of debate. But if you're taking a position on something, I'll give you an example. It used to drive me crazy that a bank I worked with in Utah would not let us do CBD loans. And it used to drive me crazy because I would say, like, okay, but now. So when I go into Whole Foods, let's see, I mapped it out on Google, and I think they're a half mile from you. When I go into Whole Foods and I buy CBD bubble bath, and I put it on my Visa card, and then that runs through Stripe, you're telling me that those products aren't banked, you know, in however, and they're like, yeah, I know. And you'd get like an answer of like, yeah, that seems kind of ridiculous. But let me just shrug my shoulders and say, like, yeah, I don't get it, but we're not changing. Those answers are illogical. And if, in fact, you, and the way we try to respond to clients, respond with a better answer, better advice, a can-do approach to solving their problems, we usually get pretty thankful people who are happy we've got their back.
Open to questions. While people think about it, when you started Lead or now managing it, what was the main sort of leadership lesson you learned from your time at Square? What did you take from Square, or what did you reject when you started it?
So when I was at Square, I oversaw hundreds of licenses. So I ran a very heavily regulated part of Square. I was not just a tech executive or, you know, an engineer or product manager. I sat on top of lending and banking, and I started a bank, First Principles. And the thing I saw at Square, which I consider to be a very strong, innovative fintech, was that owning a bank and operating a bank is a 10x delta in understanding compliance to working in a tech company. And the language you use and the mode of operation and the way that you run a company is night and day different. And even if you think, because you sit on licenses like MTLs, which is often what I hear, oh, we have MTLs, we know what we're doing. Oh, this is a different world. And so my learning, I got to learn, thankfully, in the context of Square and living it every day, was to appreciate the complexity of what it takes to do this so that we could learn how to serve our clients better and help them scale, but make sure we never put ourselves in a position to risk the relationship that we have operating with our regulators.
Question?
One of the questions I had was around this trend towards like real-time payments, kind of money being moved instantly, 24/7, and kind of gearing up towards, you know, a world where we do have instant money movement. Like, what are the things that you're thinking about for a lead bank that you need to have to be prepared to be able to facilitate, you know, this huge volume to make sure that there's, you know, you're covered in terms of like anti-fraud? Just curious, high level, like how are you thinking about that transition?
Yeah, for us around real-time payments, I don't think there's anything from a technology point of view that we need to do today to be prepared for that. We actually haven't connected to FedNow yet, even though Mark Gould, who runs it, I know very well from the Fed. I have the world's most like unbelievable respect for him. We worked at the San Francisco Fed together. I was an advisor to them for 9 years. And he's amazing, and he's methodically going through the roadmap, but we didn't have client demand for it, and so we just decided not to hook it up until we're ready. But our APIs and the way that we operate as a platform, as soon as we're ready, we're going to connect to FedNow, and I don't think there's anything we need to change. We are ready. And I think that's because of the sophistication of the systems we built thus far. And so whether it be any of the core money movement APIs or even our anomaly detection system, I think we're prepared for it from a fraud point of view. I do think they need more volume going through the system. And, you know, up to now, they've only had a few hundred banks involved. And at some point, they have enough functionality. They open up the dollar value of each transaction you're allowed to send. And the functionality grows enough that it actually can be an unbelievable platform. And that's when I think you're going to see unbelievable growth.
Do you think that lead bank is a model for community banking in general, given there are lots of questions about the future of community banking?
You know, I don't, in a sense. One of the things that I think is problematic about many of the banks that have operated in banking as a service is that they've done it opportunistically. They've fallen into a client because of a lawyer, an accountant, an advisor, or it came through their local area by fluke. But they're working with people who I don't think truly understand the products. And that's when I think banks get into trouble. If they're not able to explain the products to regulators, all of a sudden you get a very squishy feeling that it's unclear that they've done the appropriate amount of compliance, KYB, KYC checks that they need to be doing, or even red flags, SARs, you name it. And so I'm very weary of banks trying to be opportunistic of doing that. Having said that, I do think there are models for banks to deploy technology in a better way than they do. And I think that would help community banking if their apps were better, if they were able to use applications that other fintechs who serve banks sell into that channel. And so I do think there's a market for them to deploy third-party technology in order to offer different kinds of services. I see a need for community banking. I see what we do at a local level. Even though I'm the biggest advocate for lending in context of where transactions happen, I think there's an and, not an or. And the and is being part of a local community and lending to people that a fintech might not reach, or supporting part of the community at the most local level with entrepreneurs who come in, you know, and hang out in your office on a Tuesday and, you know, learn different financial skills. There's so many things that happen in order to make the texture of a community better. And so I don't know that we need 4,000 banks, but we certainly need community banking across the United States to thrive. And so I do hope technology more integrates into the banks, as opposed to banks deciding that they can necessarily go build for, you know, the most sophisticated technology companies in the world.
Just you get the last word, like a zoom out sort of question. You know, it feels like sort of coming out of the wilderness, or hopefully if there aren't more bank crises, you know, it's like Silicon Valley went through this SVB crisis, FRB, there were the crypto banks, and then fintech overall is retrenched. You know, would you tell somebody to start a fintech company today, or what message would you give people about what they should do going forward, reacting to sort of all these, I don't know, traumas?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you heard in our last presentation, it's, you know, a huge part of the economy. $25 trillion of assets sit in the banking system. And the one thing I think is amazing about fintech is that it provides real functionality that everybody uses every day. And so I do think there's such an incredible market opportunity. You know, it's really just open to creativity. Now, I think it's actually harder to build fintechs than it is many other kinds of companies, because precision and regulation are two components of the ecosystem and value chain that have to be built, where in some cases you don't need precision. And so I think there's incredible utility that fintechs provide. And because it's such an important part of the US economy, and because banking is such an old industry where more than 50% of the market cap is over 50 years old, there's an incredible room for invention everywhere along financial services, including in consumer companies. And this idea of having banking and financial transactions happen in context of where you are. It doesn't have to look like a bank app in order to be banking.
Great, Jackie, thank you so much. Thanks everybody for coming.
That's our episode. I'm Eric Newcomer. Thanks so much for listening. Shout out to GECO and Bain Capital Ventures for sponsoring the Newcomer Banking Summit. You can follow along with more coverage of the summit at newcomer.co, and check out our YouTube channel where we'll be posting conversations from the summit. Thanks so much.